So the question was, we say things appear real to us, but they're not. Does that real mean inherent existence? In that context, yes, real means inherent existence. However, the term real is a very confusing one in Buddhism because it's used differently in different contexts. Okay? Because in one way, for example, we talk about reality. Yeah, the Tibetan word is dharmata. Now, it's not, I'm sorry, that's the Sanskrit word. So dharmata is translated as reality, usually refers to ultimate reality, how things usually exist. In other words, that they're empty of inherent existence. However, sometimes the word is used to mean, it's translated as conventional reality, meaning, you know, how things conventionally exist. Okay, I mean, there is a microphone here, there is a thermos and a flower. Okay, these things are conventional reality. But on the other hand, conventional reality is not real. Okay, why? Because it doesn't inherently exist. Yeah. But then there's other words that that you translate as real and in Tibetan, and then you say, well, they are real. For example, it's another way of discriminating real and unreal. We would say the flower is real, but the reflection of the flower in the mirror is not real. Okay, so that's another way of using real and unreal. But on the other hand, in another context, the flower is not real because it's a falsity, because it appears inherently existent, although it isn't. But on the other hand, it is part of conventional reality because it exists conventionally, nominally. Okay, but it's not real because it's not inherently existent. So you see, there's many words like this I've discovered after going around in circles many times that have different meanings in different contexts. Yeah, the word true is another one. You know, that is just, it can be really confusing in, you know, different contexts. Even the word ultimate, you know. You could say emptiness is the ultimate truth, but it isn't ultimately existent. Yeah, why? Because nothing's ultimately existent, because if it ultimately exists, it would be inherently exist. The only kind of existence there is conventional existence. So emptiness is an ultimate truth that exists conventionally. Okay, are you confused enough? Good. Okay, I did my job. Yeah?
Or is this partly a translation thing? Like, are the Sanskrit Tibetan words different that we use one word away?
No, the Tibetan and Sanskrit words are used in different ways in different contexts. You know? And it's confusing for us. Because, I mean, when you're a native English speaker, you know that English words are used in different ways in different contexts. Okay? But when we go to another language, we want one word to mean one thing that's real clear in all contexts. But language isn't like that. Yeah?
I was reading one of those things you said. And I understand the form is empty, for the concept of it, but the emptiness is form.
Okay, so she's asking the Heart Sutra, form is empty and emptiness is form. Okay, form is empty, meaning that form is empty of inherent existence. Okay. But then emptiness is form. Okay, it doesn't mean emptiness itself is form. It means that emptiness exists because form exists. That emptiness is not is inseparable from form. Okay, because we often tend to think of the two truths, conventional truth, of which form is an example here, and emptiness, we often think of them as two diametrically opposed things that are unrelated to each other, you know, conventional truth is here. Yeah, emptiness, ultimate truth is, you know, somewhere in space somewhere or some other realm of, reality that you have to, you know, that exists only for some people, you know, some absolute something, something, okay? But it's not like that, yeah? Emptiness and conventional truth are one nature. They're right here. Yeah. Remember Lama used to always say to us, emptiness is right here, dear. Don't look for it anywhere else. Yeah. You don't have to go to another planet. It's right here. Okay? And what he was really emphasizing is that it's true, emptiness is right here. It's the actual nature of everything. Yeah. We don't perceive it, but it's right here. Yeah. So don't think of emptiness as some absolute something that's unrelated to anything else. Sometimes ultimate truth is mistakenly translated as absolute truth. That really gives the wrong idea, you know, that it's an absolute truth unrelated to everything. Emptiness is the whole field within which everything exists. It's not some absolute unrelated thing. So because things are empty, they can exist conventionally. If they weren't empty, if they were inherently existent, they couldn't exist at all. Okay? Because if things are inherently existent, it means they exist independent of anything else. Now, what are you going to find that exists independent of anything else? That doesn't depend either on causes and conditions, or on its parts, or on the mind that conceives and labels it. Yeah? How can you establish something as existent without it having a reliable cognizer that apprehends it? Okay? You can't. Things exist in relationship to other things. So, you know, emptiness is not an absolute truth unrelated to everything else. It's completely related. It's because things are empty that then, within that, cause and effect can function, you know, labeling can function, everything can happen. If things weren't empty, they would be permanent. Yeah, because something that's independent of everything else is permanent. So if things were empty, I mean, if things were inherently existent, they would be empty. If they would be independently existent, if they're independent, they would be permanent. They're permanent. They can't arise and cease. Okay? So that means we would all be frozen in space. Yeah, but that isn't reality, is it? We're changing all the time. So just that fact proves that things can't be independent. They have to be dependent.
Mm-hmm.
What does emptiness depend on? It depends on the conventional truth that it is the emptiness of. That's what I mean. Emptiness is not some unrelated thing. You have the conventional truth of the flower, and then you have the emptiness of the flower. The emptiness of the flower depends upon the flower. If the flower didn't exist, you couldn't have the emptiness of the flower. So there's no emptiness out there that's not the emptiness of something. Yeah. Emptiness is permanent in the sense that it's not produced by causes and conditions, but it does depend on the conventional phenomena. Because it's not emptiness like, you know, stuff like I was saying, some unrelated thing. It's the emptiness of the flower, the emptiness of the thermos, the emptiness of you, the emptiness of him, the emptiness of me. There's the emptiness of each conventionally existent object. Okay, there's no emptiness that's the emptiness of a non-existent. Yeah? So when it says form and emptiness is form, it means that the two of these things are inseparable. Yeah, you can't have one without having the other. So therefore, emptiness is dependent upon the things that it is, that it is the emptiness of. And those things are dependent on emptiness. Okay, so the flower could not exist if it were not empty. So the flower's, you know, being here depends upon the emptiness of the flower. And the emptiness of the flower depends on the flower. And you can't separate the two. Okay. In fact, they're said to be one nature, but nominally different. Grok that one. Okay. One nature, meaning you can't separate them out. You can't have one without the other. But they aren't the same thing. The emptiness and the conventional object are not the same thing. But they depend on each other.
Put something over your jacket on.
Yeah, Jean.
Could you talk about the mind stream that migrates from one being to another in terms of emptiness and permanence or emptiness?
Okay, so talking about the mind stream that transmigrates. And I'm not going to say from one being to another. Okay? But the emptiness that transmigrates in terms of emptiness and impermanence. Okay? Well, it's because things are empty, because they're impermanent, that rebirth can happen. Yeah? If things were not empty, okay, if they were an inherently existent, you know, person or soul or whatever you wanted to make it, something that is fixed and static and definitely you, independent of everything else, then that thing could never change. So there would be no rebirth. In fact, you couldn't even grow old. In fact, you couldn't even be born because nothing would change. Okay, it's inherently existent. It has its own nature, independent of everything else. Okay, so because things don't exist that way, then rebirth can happen. Okay, now the question comes: well, what is reborn? Okay, what is reborn is the merely labeled I. Okay. That is the only thing that goes from one life to the next, is the merely labeled I. But remember, you can't find the merely labeled I when you search for it to draw a circle around it. Okay? Because the merely labeled I is merely labeled. Okay? It's not something there that exists without being labeled. Doesn't have its own nature. So what is the basis of the merely labeled I? At different times, it's different things. Okay? Let's go back to, we were talking about Seattle yesterday. Okay? In the 1800s, the basis of the label Seattle, or let's say in the 1900s, you know, there was a big earthquake, wasn't there, sometime in the early 1900s? 1912, you said? Okay, so you can go on this tour in Seattle, and they take you underground to where the old city was. So, in 1911, let's say, was the basis of the label Seattle was all those buildings, you know, that are now underground. Okay, the basis of, and some of them don't exist anymore. Today, the basis of the label are the buildings that are above ground, and it looks completely different. If you saw a picture of Seattle in 1911 and you saw it now, would you be able to tell that they were in the same continuum? I think you might have some difficulty with it, yeah? Because so much was destroyed. And yet, they both have the name Seattle, don't they? But the basis of the label, what you're labeling Seattle independence upon, has totally changed. We say Gina. Your parents named you Gina. Okay? Gina had aggregates as a baby. So there was the baby body. That was called, Independence Pandwa, which your parents said Gina. Okay. Then there's the person who's, I don't know how old you are now, but this adult Gina. Yeah. If you saw the baby body and the adult one, could you tell that they were in a continuity? Probably pretty difficult. Okay. The basis of the label is totally different. Yeah, your body when you were a baby is completely different than your body now. And yet still, the same name applies. Even though the basis of the label is totally different. Okay? So in the same way, this life, we say I, there's a general I that we say I, this life. That is merely labeled in dependence upon the aggregates that we have now. Yeah, our gross body, our gross mind. At the time of death, this body is, bye-bye. And then our mind absorbs into some very, very refined state. But the mind's changing moment by moment by moment by moment. So this gross personality, also bye-bye. Okay? All of our knowledge, bye-bye. All of our, identity, I am this, I am that, bye-bye. Yeah, there's just clarity and awareness moment by moment by moment by moment. Okay? And there's a very subtle energy wind that accompanies that. Independence upon that, we label I at the moment of death. Okay? But you can see that basis of the label I and now are very, very different, aren't they? Yeah. Then that extremely subtle energy wind and consciousness, goes into the next life. Then you develop some other body, another gross body like this. Here's samsaric being anyway. So we get this kind of gross body. Then we have gross aggregates, we start seeing and hearing. Then we develop another whole conception, this is me, I'm Egyptian and I live in this village and, I believe in this and this and this, or, wherever you're born, I'm a hell being, whatever our identity becomes, okay? That is the continuity of this general I. But the basis of the label is very different. It's labeled on the aggregates of that of the next rebirth. Okay? So we have this general I. Yeah. That is labeled independence upon whatever aggregates we happen to have. Or whatever aggregates exist at any particular time in that ever-changing continuity of which there is no permanent, fixed, identifiable owner. Okay?
Is the subtle wind permanent?
No, the subtle wind is not permanent. It changes moment by moment.
How is it different for someone that is not
going to
be reborn?
Okay. Well, so somebody who's not going to be reborn. So let's start with the arhats, the beings who have attained liberation. So they, at the time of death in their final life, like let's say they're in a human body when they attain final liberation, then, the human aggregates stop. From the tantric viewpoint, there's still the continuity of this extremely subtle body and mind. From the sutra viewpoint, you do have the consciousness there, and you have a body that's called a mental body. And that consciousness remains in meditative equipoise on emptiness until the Buddha wakes it up and says, gotta generate bodhicitta and become a Buddha. Okay. For a being on the bodhisattva path, an Arya Bodhisattva who has full control over their rebirth process. They do not take rebirth in samsara under the force of ignorance the way we do, but by the force of their compassion, then they can manifest in this world. So they still have five aggregates. The Buddha also has five aggregates, but they're quite different than our aggregates. Our aggregates are very gross. Our aggregates, our body and mind, are under the control of afflictions and karma. The Buddha's aren't.
If one were to do close observation of the body and mind, and awareness of in meditation and kind of awareness of the impermanence, is that a way to move on to emptiness? Is that a useful thing to do?
Okay, so is being attentive to impermanence, specifically watching the impermanence of the body and mind, is that a way to lead you into emptiness? I think it's very helpful. Yeah. The realization of impermanence is different than the realization of emptiness, but still it pulls us out of at least the hallucination that we're some fixed thing. Yeah. If from there realizing that things are impermanent, you know, if then you can see that the person arises due to causes and conditions, that the person exists by being merely labeled, and that there's nothing findable within the basis of designation that is the labeled object, then all of that can lead you to emptiness. Okay, so what meditation would you use? You can use the four foundations of mindfulness. You know, mindfulness of body, feelings, mind, and phenomena. You can use that. You can also just contemplate that things are impermanent because they're product of causes. Yeah? The four foundations of mindfulness, it's taught in both the Theravada and the Mahayana tradition. And a question I have is, you know, this is my own question, my own hypothesis, is I think that you can do them in slightly different ways so that you realize slightly different things. In other words, in the Theravada tradition, when you do it, you really do the four foundations of mindfulness to understand impermanence, to understand dukkha, and to understand non-self. But the Theravada definition, at least according to the Tibetans, I'm not sure if this is the Theravada definition, because I haven't been able to get a clear answer when asking the questions from my Theravada friends. Is that there's no person, self-sufficient, substantially existent person that's the owner of the aggregates. Okay? But I think, and this needs to be checked, that there should be a way to do the Four Foundations mindfulness where you meditate on the emptiness of all four of those, and then the emptiness of the self that is imputed in dependence upon them.
On the issue of transmigration, I heard a tape where you were relating some teachings you received from Vajrasattva on how karma migrates, and I'm not able to ask this question, so. It was very interesting, but you know, I'm not quite sure that I understood it. And my sort of understanding was sort of related to like potential energy, like in the atmosphere, there's like a potential energy, and then there's callus of some sort, and boom, you have a flash of lightning. Is that kind of like we're creating sort of a potential energy, and then the callus of as I go for something like that, you know, it creates like that thought of karma in that being.
I was with you until the last
day. Okay, so the rebirth, let's say the rebirth then becomes a catalyst for that karma to brighten the way lightning would flash in the sky.
Okay, so you're saying the way lightning would flash in the sky would be a catalyst and make everything crystallize, or like when you stick a string in your chemical thing and all the crystals form on it. So, you know, things are really complex. the whole system, you know, causes and condition dependent arising, they say only a Buddha has the full clairvoyance, knowing exactly all the diverse causes and conditions that lead something to happen. Only a Buddha knows that, okay? That means the rest of us only have a chunk, or, you know, a grain. Okay? But when we talk about karma, you know, we do actions. The actions themselves cease. There is what's called the disintegration of the action, you know, or the disintegratedness of the action. The Tibetan term shikpa is easier to use, fewer syllables, okay? But the disintegratedness of the action exists after the action ceases, okay? That disintegratedness can carry with it, you know, it's a functioning phenomena. And so that could be a way that the karma, the action, the energy from that action is carried on into the future because its disintegratedness exists. Okay. Now, what makes it ripen is this whole complex of cause of conditions that are happening right now. Okay, so even, you know, we woke up this morning, we had a whole ton of karma on our mind stream, you know, this, all these various actions we did that, you know, the residual jikpas up in, you know, are there. But we're not quite sure which ones are going to ripen this day because it depends on what conditions, you know, there are arising that day that could trigger different things ripening. Yeah. We think we know what's going to happen each day, but we don't. Yeah. And so, you know, some slight condition here, there, the other place could prompt, you know, the ripening of some karma. Or it could not prompt the ripening. You know, sometimes it isn't just one condition. You need a whole conglomerate of conditions to be there. And sometimes it's not just one karma that ripens. It's a whole bunch of them that ripen together. Okay? But the whole idea of causes being something like the principal cause that causes the phenomena, and then the conditions that are present at the moment that make the cause ripen, you know, and change. Both of them are really, really important. I mean, because without the initial causal energy, you could have all the conditions there and you're not going to have a result. But even if you had the causal energy, if you don't put yourself in those conditions, then that energy is not going to ripen either.
So the more you practice, the change you have of those conditions come together through some...
I missed the first part.
So the more you practice, the better change you have of all the causes, conditions lining up to produce positive karma.
Yeah, and also the more you practice, the more positive karma you're putting in your mind stream, the more positive seeds, so that there's a better chance, you know, that something can ripen. And then the more your mind, you're training your mind to be in a wholesome state, and a wholesome mental state sets the stage for the ripening of positive karma. You know, that's why they say at the time of death, if we can take refuge at the time we're dying, then it's impossible to have a lower rebirth. Because just having the mind state of refuge, which is a virtuous mental state, creates the conditions for a positive karma to ripen. But how are we going to have a a virtuous mental state at the time we die, well, we have to practice having one while we're alive. It's not going to arise at the time of death just out of the clear blue sky. You know, we are creatures of habit, so we have to create that energy now. Yeah.
I was reading that there's an antidote for negative karma.
Mm-hmm.
Can you
Okay, so the antidote for negative karma. Good question. We all need this antidote. Okay, it's called the Four Opponent Powers, and you can find it in most of my books. But the first one is to have regret for whatever actions we did, not guilt, but regret. And then second, restore the relationship in our own mind. So if we had some negative action done in relationship to the three jewels or our spiritual mentor, then to take refuge. Or if it was in relationship to other sentient beings, then to generate bodhicitta. The third power is the determination to avoid the action in the future. And the fourth opponent power is some remedial action. So let's say in the context of Chenrezig, we're reciting Om Mani Padme Hum and the other mantras and imagining the light coming and purifying us. Okay? So four opponent powers is very important practice. Really important practice.
You could also do things like study the long term or
mm-hmm. Yeah, those all the other meditations act as the remedial the power of remedy also. Yeah. But you need to have the regret and the determination and the refuge and bodhicitta to make it complete. Mm-hmm.